Hello, good evening, good day. I hope you're all doing very well and welcome to the latest episode, the 10th episode of the Ask Abhijit show of the Indian interest. I apologize, of the Indian interest. So before we begin, let me get into who all is there. Let's see who all is there with us. I can see Bhumika, Parthiv, Manish, Samarth, Shivraj, Akwon, Mazar, Twilight, Vaibhavi, Skarm, R6, Akshit, Karan, AP, Bhumika, Vignesh, Nilab, Vladimir Putin, Divyanshu, Durga, Anant, Rituraj, Aditya, Kasta Jivana, Soman, Ramesh Chand, Deopam, Jasneet Singh, Rahul, Tathagat, Saurabh, Mahir, Kishore, Pankaj, Vladimir, Adityanath, Shelby now, Akshit, Samarpan, Pratham, Rituraj, Charan, Yash, Trupti, Aditya, Avijit Sarkar, Pranay, Kumar, Tapas, Nilab, and lots and lots and lots of other people. Good evening, good day to all of you. I hope you're all doing very well. Welcome to the latest episode of the Indian Interest. So what shall we discuss today? As always, there's a whole lot happening in the world. And these days, we mostly discuss geopolitics on this show. And we talk about what all things are happening right now. So let us talk about, well, what are the major things that are happening in the world right now? Well, obviously, we have the Ukraine conflict and there are major new developments vis-a-vis this conflict that we are going through right now. So let's take a look at what's happened. There is this claim made by the Russians that the Ukrainians are planning or have been planning to use a dirty bomb in the conflict. So what is a dirty bomb? So let's take a look at the tweet sent out by the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And let's see what it says. So this is what the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs claimed. This is what the Russian government claimed. It says that the Russian Defense Ministry has discovered that according to the information at hand, two organizations of Ukraine have been directly ordered to create a so-called dirty bomb. And the work is at its concluding stage. Yes. And obviously, people have expressed skepticism about these claims and so on. But let's take a look at what this is. So it says that Ukraine has capabilities. It has a capacity to create a dirty bomb. It has various sources of radioactive substances, storage pools, radioactive waste storage facilities, scientific research reactors. And it says that it's using primarily two materials, uranium-235 and plutonium-239. That's one claim. And there's another tweet as well. Let's put that out also on the screen. Where is the other tweet? Right, here it is. Let me put it out. Give me a second. So it says that the Kiev regime plans to camouflage the explosion of this kind of ordnance under an extraordinary effect of Russian low-power nuclear warhead that contains highly enriched uranium in its charge. So essentially, the Russians are saying that the Ukrainians will detonate this kind of bomb, and then they will say it was a Russian nuclear warhead that has been exploded by the Russians. And yeah, it goes on further to put out these what it calls evidence of radiation hazardous facilities of Ukraine and so on and so forth, various the Kharkov Institute of Physics and Technology and various other things. So it says that these facilities or establishments in Ukraine have the capability to create thousands of tons of this radioactive waste and other substances per year. So essentially, they're saying that Ukrainians are very much capable of carrying out this sort of thing, this sort of operation, a dirty bomb, right? And what happened is that the Russian defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, he has had no communication with the West for many months, essentially ever since the Ukraine conflict began. So he has had no communication with the West for many months. And then overnight he goes and he communicates with the American, his American counterpart, his British counterpart, his French counterpart, even his Turkish counterpart, right? Because Turkey is also a member of NATO, which is under the US sphere of influence. So all of a sudden, on the same day or in just a couple of days, he goes on and communicates with all these people, the Americans, the British, the French, the Russians, the Turks, I beg your pardon. And we also know that he has communicated with the Indian Defense Minister, Mr. Rajnath Singh as well. And in these communications with the West, essentially, Sergei Shoigu went ahead and laid out what he says the Russians have discovered, that the Ukrainians on behalf of the West essentially are planning to carry out a dirty bomb operation in this conflict. So that's what Russia has claimed. And like I said, he also had a conversation with let's put out one more tweet by the Russian foreign ministry, and then we will put out the communication by India as well. So the Russian foreign ministry, there's a third tweet they have put out. It is a statement by Maria Zakharova, who is the spokesperson there. Reliable sources indicate that Kiev is planning a provocation with the use of a dirty bomb. The purpose of this heinous provocation is clear: to accuse Russia of using a weapon of mass destruction. Kiev is planning to detonate a dirty bomb by disguising it as an unauthorized burst of a low-yield Russian nuclear bomb with enriched uranium. The West should not be measuring the width of the red line. That's what Maria Zakharova has said. So this is the allegation that the Russians have made. Now let's put out what India has said, the Indian statement. This is in response, this is as a consequence of the conversation that Sergei Shoigu had with the Indian Defense Minister, Mr. Rajnath Singh. It says, telephonic conversation between Raksha Mantri Shri Rajnath Singh and Defense Minister of Russia, Mr. Sergei Shoigu. Raksha Mantri Shri Rajnath Singh held a telephonic conversation with Mr. Sergei Shoigu on October 26 at the latter's request. During the conversation, both ministers discussed bilateral defense cooperation as well as the deteriorating situation in Ukraine. Defense Minister Shoigu briefed the Raksha Mantri on the evolving situation in Ukraine, including his concerns about possible provocations through use of a dirty bomb. Shri Rajnath Singh reiterated India's position on the need to pursue the path of dialogue and diplomacy for an early resolution of the conflict. He pointed out that the nuclear option should not be resorted to by any side, as the prospect of the usage of nuclear or radiological weapons goes against the basic tenets of humanity, and both ministers agreed to remain in touch. This is the statement put out by India, by the Indian government, right? So this is what's happening. The Russians have publicized to the whole world, they've broadcasted all over the world that the Ukrainians are planning to, or are hoping to, or are in the process of they want to detonate a dirty bomb. So let's understand what a dirty bomb is. What is a dirty bomb? Is there a dirty bomb as opposed to a clean bomb or any such thing? So dirty bomb is essentially one type of a weapon of mass destruction. It's a weapon of mass destruction. A dirty bomb, essentially, it can come in three different varieties. It can be a radioactive dirty bomb, it can be a chemical dirty bomb, or it could be a biological dirty bomb. So a dirty bomb is essentially a conventional bomb that is laced with radioactive or biological or chemical materials. So when a dirty bomb explodes, it scatters these materials over a certain area, right? So in the case of the radioactive dirty bomb, which is the matter under consideration, it will be a regular conventional bomb, maybe a very powerful conventional bomb, which is laced with a whole lot of radioactive material. So what kind of radioactive material could be used? So typically when people in academia, in geopolitics, etc., when people have discussed dirty bombs, they have typically discussed it from the perspective of terrorism. The terrorists could somehow obtain some radioactive substances and then mix that with a regular bomb and then use it on, well, whatever target they intend to contaminate, right? Now, where would terrorists obtain such radioactive sources from? Well, we know that radioactive sources are used widely in medicine, for instance, in academia, and also in various industries, right? So, for instance, when I was a student studying nuclear physics, if you are studying nuclear physics at the master's level, at the university level, then in the lab, you get to handle radioactive substances, radioactive samples. So I think it... Well, I will not mention what radioactive substances I, as a student, handled, but there are various. It will not include uranium or plutonium. It will include certain other radioactive elements. So, if you want a list of what radioactive substances could be used in a dirty bomb, you have cobalt-60, which has a half-life of about 5 years. You have cesium-137 that has a half-life of about 30 years. Then you have americium-241, which has a half-life of more than 400 years. So that is dangerous. Then you have iridium-192 that has a very brief half-life of 74 days. Then you have strontium-90, which has a half-life of about 30 years. You have californium-252, which has a half-life of about 900 years. And then you have the usual suspects, uranium-234, 235, 238. And we also have plutonium-238. Plutonium. We also have plutonium. I forget the number, but it's plutonium. There are two isotopes of plutonium, which are both extremely hazardous. They are extremely toxic as well as radioactive, right? So typically, in a dirty bomb, you would use any of these things. But if you use plutonium, that could be very dangerous. And the uranium, the Russians are claiming that the Ukrainians intend to use either uranium or plutonium or both, right? Depleted uranium and plutonium-239, I think that's what they said. So plutonium-238 is the weapons-grade plutonium, and the spent, 239 is what they don't use in nuclear weapons, but it's still radioactive. So let's say you use plutonium. You have a very powerful conventional explosive, right? A very powerful conventional bomb. And then you add in, let's say, a kilo. Let's say, hypothetically, a kilo of plutonium dust in the form of, let's say, plutonium oxide, right? And then you detonate it over whatever target you intend to contaminate. So this 1 kilogram of plutonium dust that is going to be thrown around, it is enough to give cancer to nearly 5 million people. 1 kilogram of plutonium oxide dust. So that's how deadly it is. And it's going to render the entire area, wherever the contamination happens, completely unlivable. It's almost impossible to get rid of the contamination. I mean, there are various means and ways you can use, but it's essentially contaminated for a very long time and so on. So that's what a dirty bomb is. You can use radioactive waste materials. You can use any of the various isotopes that I specified and so on. So that is what a dirty bomb is. And if you explode this over, let's say, well, wherever you do it, it's going to be a disaster, a genuine disaster, environmental catastrophe. It's going to give cancer to lots of people. It's going to render the soil unusable for agriculture. It's going to contaminate and kill animals. It's going to destroy forests. Those forests, you cannot go there, right? It's going to leach into the groundwater. It's a disaster. It'll contaminate rivers or ponds or lakes or whatever it is. It's something you never ever want to see happen, right? So that is what the Russians are alleging, and it appears that they obtained this information apparently by tapping undersea data cables. So you have data cables that carry various kinds of data, internet communications, and so on and so forth. These data cables are laid on the bottoms of the oceans, right? And that's so the Russians, obviously, they have the capability to tap these data cables either via submarines or via surface ships or whatever. But they have apparently succeeded in tapping data cables and gaining access to various communications. And that's how they apparently got this information, right? So the Russians are saying the Ukrainians are planning this sort of thing. As soon as the Russians declared this, the Ukrainians made a counterclaim that the Russians themselves are planning to do this and they want to lay the blame on Ukraine. So both sides are accusing the other of a false flag operation, right? A false flag operation is an operation in which you... What's a false flag operation? Let's say I'm fighting a war. Let's say a nation is fighting a war and they want to accuse the other side of something terrible. So they will conduct a military operation against themselves, a limited military operation against themselves, and put various kinds of false evidence that makes it look like the other side has carried it out. And then you blame them of doing terrible things, and then you can take certain actions based on these claims. That's a false flag operation. So the Russians are accusing Ukraine of doing this. The Ukrainians are accusing Russia of doing this. So now what do we make of this? So let's say something like this happens. All you have to ask yourselves is, what does each side gain by doing this? What does Russia gain? Let's say Russia carries out this sort of thing, a dirty bomb operation. What will Russia gain from this? It will gain international opprobrium. Everybody in the world will condemn Russia, right? And if this happens, if the Russians do this, then even those nations that have been supporting Russia in various ways, either directly or indirectly, or by refusing to condemn the war in Ukraine, even those nations will be forced to distance themselves from Moscow. So if Russia carries this out, it's a disaster for Russia. Right? Now, what does Ukraine gain? What does the West gain if something like this happens? First of all, Ukraine will essentially gain indefinite and unlimited support from the West, from the US, because they are the big victims. Somebody carried out, Russia carried out a nuclear dirty bomb attack on Ukraine. Obviously, they will gain unlimited and indefinite support from the West. It will help when it comes to domestic politics in the US. It will help Republicans regain control of Congress in the upcoming elections. Yeah. Because, well, they will say, see, we told you so. This is what the Russians have been doing. They are the bad guys and you do not listen to us. So support us, vote for us, and so on. So it could help the Republicans regain control of Congress in US domestic politics. The third main consequence, it will pressurize China and India to distance themselves unconditionally from Russia. The Chinese have refused to condemn Russia. They have been purchasing Russian oil to some extent and so on and so forth, right? Then they are adopting this official position of principled neutrality. India has refused to condemn Russia. India has said, we need to resolve this diplomatically and so on, but it has not outright condemned Russia. And India has been buying enormous amounts of Russian oil, discounted Russian oil. India has been, ever since the conflict started, India has been buying, about 50 times more oil than it was buying previously. And this has essentially helped Russia not fall into the Chinese embrace and not fall prey to Chinese hopes of turning Russia into a vassal state. India's support has essentially saved Russia from annihilation. So if the Russians do such a thing, it will exert incredible amounts of pressure on China and India to unconditionally distance themselves from Russia, and that will be the end of Russia if that happens. Right? And this sort of attack happens, it also gives the United States the pretext to directly intervene or get involved in Ukraine, boots on the ground. So this essentially isolates Moscow completely. It sets the stage for Moscow's eventual destruction, economically at least, right? And one other consequence of this, or benefit of such an attack, is it gives the prospect of big profits to big pharma from treating millions of affected Europeans, right? So if you look at these, the benefits, the pros and cons of this, then it's very clear that this is not in Russia's interest. Detonating a dirty bomb on any part of the world, in Ukraine or wherever else, is not in Russia's interest. It is entirely against Russia's interests, and it is entirely in favor of Ukraine's interests, or Kiev's interest, or the West's interest. So that tells us where this, if the Russians are right, and if they have actually discovered a plot to detonate a dirty bomb, then I think it's very clear, if this allegation is true, then it's very clear who benefits from this. The Russians certainly do not benefit from this. They will lose the support of China and India. And even Iran may be forced to break off communications and ties with Russia. It will isolate Russia completely. It would be madness for Russia to do such a thing. So now that Russia has publicized this, it becomes more difficult for whoever wants to do this to do it. And it may yet happen. It may yet happen. I hope it never ever happens. I hope that nobody ever uses nuclear weapons or dirty bombs or anything like this in the future ever again. But, you know, we are living in bad times. We're living in dangerous times. In geopolitics, it's not about good or bad, right or wrong or anything. It's about what I gain from it. And it's very clear who stands to gain from the detonation of a dirty bomb in this conflict. It's definitely not Russia. Russia stands to lose all the gains it has made. It would be complete and utter madness for Russia to resort to a dirty bomb tactic. So that's what I have to say about this. If you have any rebuttals or any other perspective that you would like to give, then after the live stream is over, you can put that in the comments. I would be happy to see all perspectives and maybe learn something. But from my analysis, it doesn't make any sense for Russia to resort to a dirty bomb tactic. So that's where we are vis-a-vis this. Now, let's understand the Ukraine war better. This conflict that began in February this year. What is this war about? Now, if you are a short-sighted person, what do I mean by a short-sighted person? Somebody who sees history or geopolitics or current events from a very narrow perspective. You see it only from the lens of the last 10 years. What happened in the last 10 years? If you have a narrow perspective, you will entirely blame Russia for what happened. Yes? If you look at it from a 50-year or 100-year perspective, or even from a post-1990s perspective, then you will understand where the real blame lies, where the blame really lies. Right? Anyhow, so let's understand what the Ukraine war is. And to understand the Ukraine war, you have to understand something called the Heartland Theory. It is a theory that was put forth by an English geostrategist called Halford Mackinder. So this person, Halford Mackinder, put forth the Heartland Theory in 1904. This guy died in 1947, right? And he put forth this theory in an article called The Geographical Pivot of History. So now let's take a look at what this is. Let me put something on the screen which will help you understand what I am seeing. So this is Mackinder's Heartland Theory, or is it too small? Let me embiggen or bigify this. One second. Give me a second. Let me bigify, embiggen, enlarge the image. Okay, now it makes a little more sense. So this is the diagram at the heart of this theory. It will help you understand better. So according to Halford Mackinder, the world is divided into several sections. The main section is the so-called World Island, which is made up of the interlinked continents of Europe, Asia, and Africa. So this is essentially Eurasia plus Africa. This is what Mackinder called the World Island, right? Then he had another section called the Offshore Islands, which essentially, according to him, are the British Islands, the islands of Japan, etc. Those are the offshore islands. And then there is a third section of the world called the Outlying Islands, which are the continents of North America, South America, and Oceania. So you have the World Island, you have the offshore islands, and you have the outlying islands. Now he coined this term called the Heartland or the Pivot Area. You can see in this diagram something called the Pivot Area. So what is the heartland? What is the pivot area? It's the same thing. The pivot area lies at the center of the world island. It essentially is from the river Volga in the west to the river Yangtze in the east. And from north to south, it is the Arctic region to the Himalayas. So that region is what Mackinder called the heartland or the pivot area. And he said that so this heartland has traditionally been ruled by the Russian Empire, later by the Soviet Union, and most of it is still administered, ruled, owned by Russia. Now, what is interesting or important about the heartland or the pivot area? The heartland, the pivot area, contains more than half of the entire world's resources. It's all about resources, my friends. The pivot area contains more than half of the entire planet's resources. What do I mean by resources? I'm talking about raw materials. I'm talking about petroleum products, oil and gas, and minerals and metals, and also agriculture. These resources essentially are everything you need to indefinitely sustain a large, massive military force, right? That is the reason why the Russians have not been affected to a large extent by the US sanctions, because they have all the resources they would ever need to sustain their nation indefinitely and their military power indefinitely. So the heartland, the pivot area, contains more than half of the entire planet's resources. And the heartland is protected from sea power by the Arctic ice at the north and by mountains and deserts in the south. So it is extremely well protected. When Mackinder wrote this thesis, this article, the world's geopolitics was all about sea power. Even today, the world's geopolitics is about sea power. It's about the choke points in the oceans. It's about the trading routes and the infrastructure at sea. It's about major navies, right? At the time Mackinder wrote this thesis, the major sea powers were the UK and the US, and to some extent Germany. Even the French had a sea power, and Japan. Japan was also a sea power, right? And today, if you look at the world today, there are two major sea powers, the United States and China, right? So the heartland is protected from sea power by ice to the north and mountains and deserts to the south. That is Russia's natural protection. And this is then what Mackinder said. He said, who rules East Europe commands the heartland. Who rules the heartland commands the world island. And who rules the world island commands the world. Right? So the key to control of the heartland is East Europe. The key to control of the world island is the heartland. And the key to commanding the world is ruling the world island. So this theory, heartland theory, or Mackinder's the heartland theory, this theory was central to the politics, geopolitics of World War I, of World War II. It was central to the geopolitics of the Vietnam War and other conflicts. And it was central to the Cold War. And once again, this heartland theory is central to Cold War II and the Ukraine conflict, which we are seeing right now, right? So in Mackinder's analysis, China is what he calls a rim world power. It's laid out on the rim of the eastern part of Eurasia. So China, according to Mackinder, is a rim world power. It is vulnerable to two things. It is, first of all, vulnerable to the heartland power, the great power in the heartland, which is Russia. It is also vulnerable to the great ocean power, which is the US and NATO. In the past, it was Japan and the UK as well. In today's context, it is vulnerable to the great ocean power, which is NATO and the US. So China is vulnerable to the great heartland power, Russia, and to the US. And the Chinese also understand this. And that is why they have been investing so much on their Belt and Road initiative to connect themselves with the heartland, and also on creating a very powerful navy, which they are still working assiduously towards. So, China, according to Mackinder, is a rimland power. Mackinder makes no mention, as far as I know, about India, which is fine. So Mackinder says that the key to controlling the heartland is Eastern Europe, and the key to controlling the entire world island is the heartland, and the key to controlling the world, entire world, is to control the world island, right? Now, the United States, it understands, it takes this theory, heartland theory, very, very seriously. The entire pivot to the Indo-Pacific is essentially based on understanding the heartland theory and putting various strategies in motion to essentially, in the long run, acquire the heartland. Because the heartland... So according to Mackinder, you may be a sea power or whatever, but the true key to controlling the entire world is to become a land power in the heartland, in Eurasia, in where Russia currently rules, right? So the US today is a superpower which is in decline. And the US has always been a petro superpower. Its rise was predicated on controlling the petroleum reserves of the world, the energy reserves of the world. If the United States wants to remain the dominant great power, the dominant superpower in the world, it has to prevent Russia from securing Eastern Europe. It has to prevent Russia from securing Eastern Europe, because Eastern Europe is the key to the heartland. It is the key to Russia. And Eastern Europe is the only viable path right now for any great power to invade Russia. There are other routes as well, but those are far from becoming a reality. So if the US wants to remain the dominant great power, it has to prevent Russia from securing Eastern Europe. That is key. And if Russia is secure, then its position as the greatest landmass in the heartland will allow it to eventually, in the future, in the long term, to dominate the world. That is the heartland theory of Mackinder. So essentially, once again, let me repeat, according to this theory, whoever controls Eastern Europe will end up eventually controlling the world. Understand this. This is Mackinder's heartland theory. Now let's move on from this and take a look at the map, because we are talking about geopolitics. And one second, let me put the map on the screen. Give me a second, and we will now understand why Eastern Europe is important and what's happening right now. So, Eastern Europe. We know where Russia is. Russia, east of Russia is Eastern Europe. These are the former Soviet bloc nations, right? Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania was, and Belarus, and Ukraine, and Moldova, etc., was all part of the USSR. Poland is Eastern Europe. Czechia, Slovakia, Hungary, etc., are more or less Eastern Europe. Slovenia, Croatia was part of the Soviet bloc. Serbia, Albania, all that. Bulgaria, Romania, right? These are all the various Eastern European nations. The one nation that dominates Eastern Europe, the greatest and largest nation in Eastern Europe, the largest land area of any nation in Eastern Europe, is Ukraine. Therefore, Ukraine is the most important nation geopolitically, geostrategically in the Eastern European region, right? So if you want to prevent Russia from becoming a great dominant power, you have to ensure that Russia is not able to secure Eastern Europe. And the key to Eastern Europe is Ukraine. So the Americans have calculated and they believe that Russia wants to eventually take all of Eastern Europe, or if not take all of Eastern Europe, then establish its uncontested dominance and hegemony over Eastern Europe. That way the Americans will never be able to defeat Russia. So the key to defeating Russia in America's eyes is to take control of Eastern Europe. Now, as we know, Poland is more or less, there are many nations in Eastern Europe that have become NATO members, and many nations have expressed the urgent desire to become NATO members, right? And so on. So the Americans have been slowly, steadily, from the 1990s onwards itself, steadily they've been encroaching and expanding eastwards into Eastern Europe. When the USSR broke up in the early 1990s, the Americans were not satisfied with that. They wanted to take over the whole of Russia, right? And for a while, it was kind of what happened, because under Boris Yeltsin, the Russians opened up their economy to the Americans and they essentially destroyed their economy willingly. That's what Boris Yeltsin did. And then you had Vladimir Putin, who came to power, who did a 10-year period of consolidation of stopping the bleeding, so to say. And then Russia was back slowly, right? With the conflict in Georgia, with the conflict in Crimea, and now the Ukraine conflict. So the Americans see the Russians as wanting to slowly but steadily regain lost ground and essentially recreate the Russian Empire and what the USSR was. And that would essentially lead to the Russians eventually taking control of the whole world. That's what the Americans think or calculate or fear. And that's why the Ukraine conflict is central to the future of the world, right? Because if the Americans are able to prevent Russia from, let's say, conquering Ukraine, or if they are able to make Ukraine regain the annexed territories that Russia has recently annexed, then it could be a disaster for Russia. And eventually they could be, if the Americans can essentially make the whole of Eastern Europe a part of NATO, then they can, as a next step, strike against Russia in a variety of means, right? Especially if they can isolate Russia completely, which is where the dirty bomb angle comes in. If the Russians are accused of detonating a dirty bomb, then even India and China can be greatly pressurized to distance themselves from Russia. Then you isolate Russia, and then step by step, you take Russia out. So that is the American grand strategy. So this is all predicated on Mackinder's heartland theory. Who controls Eastern Europe will one day control the world. Right, so this is America's great bid for retaining their dominant status as the world's sole superpower. China is not doing well. I've spoken about this multiple times. The Belt and Road initiative is dead in the water, and the Chinese economy is crawling right now. They're not even revealing their GDP figures. So China is not going to become a superpower the way they had hoped anytime soon. So that leaves us with Russia. Russia can one day, once again, because of its enormous command, of its command over the enormity of more than half of the planet's resources, they can become a superpower if things go right. The Americans don't want this to happen. So the Ukraine conflict is a pivotal conflict. It is the most important conflict we have witnessed essentially since World War II. That's what's happening. It's a conflict for the future of the world, right? So that's how we need to understand this. And that's why the Americans are taking this conflict so seriously. That's why the Russians are taking it so seriously. It essentially is about the future of Russia as well. If Russia is not able to succeed in Ukraine, it could very, very much spell the beginning of the doom for Russia. What the Americans would like to do is, hopefully, not in the long-term future, take over Russia and its enormous resources. America is a petro superpower, right? And Russia has enormous resources, reserves of petroleum and oil and gas and all those things. If the Americans get access to that, if they can control that, it will guarantee American supremacy for at least another century. So that is what the game is about. The game is about controlling the key to the heartland. The key to the heartland is Eastern Europe, and the key to Eastern Europe is Ukraine. So control Ukraine, then you can control Eastern Europe. If you control Eastern Europe, you can control the entire heartland in the future. It is the gateway to the heartland. It is the gateway to Russia. And if you control the heartland, you control essentially the whole world. That is what the game is about. And that's why this conflict is extremely, extremely important for the entire world. Right? Right. So that's about that. I hope that throws some light, some clarity on why all these things are happening. Why are all these nations, these great powers, so deeply embroiled in the Ukraine conflict, and no nation is willing to give an inch when it comes to this. And that's why it is so. Now, let us talk about Pakistan, shall we? In the past, when Indians thought about foreign policy or anything, it was all about Pakistan, Pakistan, Pakistan. Now, we don't talk about Pakistan that much because I hope everybody has understood that Pakistan is it's never been a major power or a major force to deal with. It's always acted as a proxy of more powerful nations. So let us talk about Pakistan. What's happening in Pakistan right now? So we know that since 1947, India and Pakistan have had this rivalry. And successive Indian governments for decades treated Pakistan as an equal. I don't know why, but Indian governments always treated Pakistan as an equal. Even during the time of Mr. Atal Bihari Vajpayee, Mr. Vajpayee did a great job by making India a nuclear power, no doubt about it. That is one of the greatest things he did. But Mr. Vajpayee once again put Pakistan on the same pedestal as India. And not only Mr. Vajpayee, various prime ministers in India, all of them essentially treated Pakistan as an equal. So from 1947 onwards, there was this continuous, constant India-Pakistan rivalry. There was this, the Americans made it a point to hyphenate India and Pakistan. So there was no mention of India without a mention of Pakistan, and there was no mention of Pakistan without a mention of India, right? So the Americans also made it a point to treat India and Pakistan as equals. So the India-Pakistan rivalry was something that went in parallel with the US-USSR rivalry during the Cold War. And later, the India-Pakistan rivalry became a parallel to the India-China rivalry, which still continues. So these are two rivalries that have always existed in parallel. And this was also something that was very much one of the main themes of the second Cold War, Cold War 2.0, which we are currently living through, right? The rise of China and all that. So since 2012, more or less, there has been this new Cold War between the US and China. Because at that time, China was the great new emerging power and maybe the next superpower. So that was the new Cold War, the trade conflict and all those things. And the India-Pakistan rivalry was very much something that was in parallel to the US-China rivalry. Now, India and China obviously are adversaries. We have territorial conflicts. The Chinese claim Indian territory. They have illegally occupied Tibet and so on and so forth. That's a whole different story. We all know the facts. And this all culminated in the clashes between India and China, which happened recently in June 2020. We had the Galwan clash, which was the first time Indian and Chinese soldiers died. The Chinese tried to minimize the casualties. They said that only 4 Chinese soldiers died. But it's slowly emerged from a variety of sources, including Western sources, that way more Chinese soldiers died than Indian soldiers died. I think there were 20 Indian deaths and maybe 80 or 100 Chinese deaths or something like that. whatever the number is. But they, more of their soldiers died than Indian soldiers. And then there were these continuing India-China border skirmishes and clashes, you know, more or less smaller and bigger clashes that went on until 2021, right? So you had all of this happening. So the India-Pakistan rivalry was always in parallel to the US-China rivalry. At some point in time, the Americans lost interest for whatever reason in Pakistan. They gave up on Pakistan. And Pakistan then migrated into the Chinese corner. And they became a Chinese vassal in exchange for money. So then they became China's attack dog for counterbalancing India. And then India took certain very strong actions against Pakistan, which essentially ended more or less all the Pakistani terrorism in India. This happened after 2014. Before 2014, there were incidents of terrorist attacks in India almost every week or every other week. After 2014, it all ended because India, the Indian government, new Indian government under Prime Minister Modi, took very strong decisive actions against Pakistan. It sent home the message that we will not tolerate any more nonsense, right? We had the Balakot, we had the surgical strikes, the Balakot airstrike, and various other things. So Pakistan became a Chinese attack dog. Then what happened is that this year, on February 24, the Ukraine conflict started, the special military operation of Russia in Ukraine. And coincidentally, at that time, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, the then Prime Minister of Pakistan, Mr. Imran Khan, happened to be visiting Russia, right? Now, as we know, Pakistan prime ministers don't hold any real power. It's kind of like the UK prime minister or the Japanese prime minister. The Pakistani prime minister doesn't ever have any power. They do everything with the assent of the Pakistani establishment. Nothing is done without the approval of the Pakistani establishment. What is the Pakistani establishment? It is a permanent policy-making, decision-making establishment, which is made up of the military, which is the army, the armed forces. It is made up of the intelligence, which is the ISI, and to some extent, the diplomatic bureaucracy, which are extensions of the military and the intelligence establishment of Pakistan. So that is where the true power resides in Pakistan, the military and the ISI. That's where the power lies. So no Pakistani prime minister does anything without the approval of the ISI and the military. So if Mr. Imran Khan went to Moscow to meet Vladimir Putin in late February 2022, it was done with the approval of the military and the ISI. Right? Now, we know that Mr. Imran Khan is a huge fan of Indian foreign policy. He calls it India's independent foreign policy, India's proud, self-respecting foreign policy. He is known to play clips of what Dr. Jaishankar says when he's holding big rallies and all that. He puts Dr. Jaishankar's statements on the screen, you know, 30-second video clips, 60-second video clips of Dr. Jaishankar. And he has praised Indian foreign policy multiple times as an example of a truly independent and proud and self-respecting foreign policy. So Imran Khan, by nature, is somebody who has wanted to make Pakistan independent of any great power and a non-vassal state of any great power. That's what he has always wanted. His statements, even 10 years ago, were like that he wanted Pakistan to come out of the US orbit. At that time, Pakistan was in the US orbit. It was a US vassal state. Then it became a Chinese vassal state, right? So Imran Khan made this trip to Moscow in February 2022. Now, Imran Khan, we know that in 2021, in August 21, the Americans withdrew from Afghanistan. And there was talk about Americans creating, you know, various bases, military bases in Pakistan for drone overflights, for drone attacks on Afghanistan, on the Taliban, and so on and so forth, right? Because it was withdrawing from Afghanistan physically, so it would need some local bases for carrying out drone flights and operations. And there was talk about Pakistan hosting such bases, American military bases. And Imran Khan made a public statement that he was absolutely against hosting any American base on Pakistan soil after America's withdrawal from Afghanistan. So that was a big red strike on Imran Khan. I mean, publicly saying such a thing against the overlord, against the superpower. And we also know that that after Joe Biden came to power, he refused to even do a single phone call with Imran Khan because of Imran Khan's leanings towards a more independent foreign policy. So there was already this ill will towards Imran Khan in the US establishment, in the US establishment. Let's call it the establishment, right? There was this very strong ill will against Imran Khan. And then he made the statement of that he will absolutely not host any American bases on Pakistani soil after the Americans withdraw from Afghanistan, right? And then he made a trip to Moscow. And it seems to be, have been the last straw that how dare a Pakistan prime minister make a trip to Moscow when Moscow is about to launch apparently an invasion of Ukraine. And coincidentally, the day Imran Khan reached Moscow is the day, is 24 February, if I'm not mistaken. And it's the same day that Vladimir Putin authorized the operation on Ukraine. It's the day the war started, the day Imran Khan reached there. And then he met Putin for, I don't know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so. You know, a curtsy call or whatever. Vladimir Putin made sure that he did meet Imran Khan so that, out of curtsy or whatever, and there was some discussion or whatever. So the Americans took that as a big no-no, that how dare the Pakistan Prime Minister meet Vladimir Putin on the day this is happening. So it's clear that the Pakistani military and ISI had approved Imran Khan's trip to Moscow. Maybe they were aware that this would be the last straw for Imran Khan from the US perspective. Maybe they were aware of things that Imran Khan was not aware of. So anyhow, Imran Khan goes to Moscow in February 22, and by April it's done. There is this no confidence motion against Imran Khan, which again would never have succeeded without the establishment support, ISI support and military support. So Imran Khan was evicted, removed. He calls it a coup. He calls it a US-led coup against Pakistan, against the people of Pakistan, and so on and so on and so forth. In the Pakistani establishment, there are various schools of thought. There are three main schools of thought. The one school of thought says that Pakistan should remain a US vassal state. There is another school of thought that says that that Pakistan should become or should remain a Chinese vassal state. And there is a third school of thought that says that Pakistan should have a more independent and multipolar foreign policy. Right? Three schools of thought. It's clear which school of thought has emerged on top. Pakistan is now once again a US vassal state. It is no longer a Chinese vassal state. Understand this now. This is now very clear. Until 2022, until the beginning of 22, Pakistan was very much a Chinese vassal state. We had the China-Pakistan economic corridor that the Chinese were building. It was not doing very well in the past 2 years because of the pandemic and various reasons, but it's something the Chinese invested a lot of money into. The Gwadar port is essentially run by the Chinese, or more or less owned by the Chinese, and lots of Chinese investments in Pakistan, in Balochistan. There were attacks on Chinese agents in Balochistan by the Balochi freedom fighters and so on. So Pakistan was very much a Chinese vassal state. As of today, Pakistan is no longer even 1% a Chinese vassal state. Yes, the Pakistan Prime Minister will indeed go to Beijing when he's invited, and all those things will happen. That's only for keeping up appearances. Pakistan is very much, very firmly a US vassal state all over again. And after Imran Khan was removed, and after the vassal state status was reconfirmed, what happened? There were various clashes between Pakistani armed forces and the Taliban on the Afghanistan border, right? A lot of multiple clashes, ongoing series of clashes between Pakistan and Afghanistan, between Pakistan and the Taliban forces, right? We have Taliban accusing Pakistan of hosting US drones. I think it's already happening. It may or may not have been announced, but it's clear that the Pakistanis are now hosting US drones on their territory. There was a recent, not recent, there was this airstrike, drone strike in Kabul on 31 July 2022, which killed apparently Ayman al-Zawahiri, right? The second in command, then first in command of Al-Qaeda, right? So apparently he was living in Kabul, and there was a US drone strike on Kabul on 31st of July 2022. Obviously, it would have only come from Pakistan. There's no other nation nearby that was willing to host American drones. So this happened after the vassal status. And then you also had a drone strike in Kabul in August, right? So it's clear that the Pakistanis are now hosting US drones on their soil. And who knows what else? So Pakistan has now become a US vassal state all over again. What has been the reward for Pakistan? We can obviously safely assume that the Pakistani military establishment must be getting cash a good amount of cash from the Americans. The ISI must be getting a good amount of cash. Also, we obviously know this has been discussed ad nauseum, right? The nearly $500 million US aid package for Pakistani F-16 fighter planes, right? Which was announced on September 7. And did anybody notice what happened the next day? The Americans announced a $450 million aid package to Pakistan for their F-16s on September 7. What happened on September 8? On September 8, the next day, India and China announced their border disengagement. This is a major de-escalation. At the time, I said this is something that was done to facilitate Prime Minister Modi's presence in the Samarkand SCO summit, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. Yes, that would also be a factor in that. But is it a coincidence that this was announced the very next day after the Americans announced their aid package for Pakistan? The resumption of military aid to Pakistan, which is aimed only at one nation. It is only aimed at India. You know, killing terrorists using F-16s is like using a machine gun to kill ants or mosquitoes. It doesn't make any sense, right? So the aid that is being given to Pakistan to refurbish or upgrade their F-16s, it's only aimed at India. So the very next day, India and China announced their major border disengagement, which is a major de-escalation. And then what else did Pakistan gain from the Americans? On October 5, the Pakistani Chief of Army Staff, Bajwa, that fellow, he met the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, at the Pentagon. And the Americans made a big show of all the pictures, you know, of Lloyd Austin standing at the gates of the Pentagon and personally welcoming Bajwa over there in that very lavish limousine, which essentially is the same kind of honor that was given to Dr. S. Jaishankar when he visited the place, right? So they are once again treating Pakistan on par with India. They are trying to re-hyphenate Pakistan and India and all that, right? So that's the game they are playing again, the same old, good old Cold War playbook. And then we have Pakistan being pulled out of FATF. Then they have been given a clean chit, right? And we also have heard about investments in Pakistan by South Korea as well as Japan, which are two very well-known U.S. vassal states. So what does this mean? This means that the U.S. has re-established its hegemony over Pakistan. And Pakistan is now officially a U.S. vassal state. It is no longer a Chinese vassal state. The Chinese have lost control of Pakistan. Understand, the Chinese are no longer in control of Pakistan. The Americans are now firmly in control of Pakistan. So the U.S. has re-established its hegemony over Pakistan, and the U.S. in parallel has failed to establish any kind of hegemony over India. It wanted India to do its bidding and condemn Moscow and distance itself from Moscow. That's not happened. India has done the exact opposite of that in the Indian national interest. So the U.S. has established hegemony over Pakistan again. It has failed to establish hegemony over India. So what's happening now? Pakistan is now a U.S. vassal state. China has lost all control over Pakistan or is in the process of losing all control over Pakistan. What could happen in the future? Dare I make some predictions? Oh my God, how dangerous is that? What could happen in the future? Firstly, Pakistan could become once again a conduit for terror in India. That is a very dangerous game Pakistan would play because India can hit back 10 times as strong. But yes, that could happen. I don't want it to ever happen. But let's understand that this is a possibility. Secondly, Pakistan could become a conduit for terror in Xinjiang. Do we know where Xinjiang is? Let's go to the map. We must always go to the map. Where is Xinjiang? It is north of Tibet. We know where Nepal is. Yes, my dear friends. North of Nepal, you have Tibet. North of Bhutan, you have Tibet. Both Desh, which is currently occupied by China. And north of Tibet, you have what was once called East Turkestan. The capital is Urumqi, right? And you had other Silk Road cities there, like Khotan, which was founded by Indians during the Mauryan times and so on. So this region, north of Tibet, is called Xinjiang or Yeah, Xinjiang. So that is a place where you have this independence struggle. The Uyghurs live there. The Uyghurs, I'm sure you all know who the Uyghurs are. These are Turkic people. They are like half Turkic, half Indian origin. Once upon a time, this entire region was Indian, Indic in culture and ethnicity. Then there were the Turkic invasions, as a consequence of which you have the Uyghurs who sprang up from the soil. And the Uyghurs are essentially like half Indian, half Turkic. And they are obviously, the religion they practice is Islam. And they are fighting this religious independence struggle. Let's just call it an independence struggle against the Chinese, right? And as we know, Pakistan has supported China thus far and turned a blind eye on what the West claims are Chinese atrocities in Xinjiang, possibly even a genocide, which may actually be happening. I don't know, right? We don't know. Because we don't have first-hand evidence, but that's what the West has been claiming. And Pakistan has thus far kept very quiet about this. Imran Khan himself once said that I have no idea what's happening there in a television interview with a Western media outlet or whatever it was. So now that Pakistan is once again a US puppet, Pakistan could become a conduit for terror in Xinjiang. Then what else could happen? Pakistan could destabilize Afghanistan further, making it completely useless for a revival of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. The Chinese would like this Belt and Road thing to restart. It's right now completely frozen. It's completely stopped. Yeah, they in the future, if they want to revive the BRI, the Belt and Road Interface, they would want to, because Afghanistan is one of the major nations in this way. It was part of the ancient Silk Route and all that. So the Chinese would want it to go through Afghanistan for sure. That's one of the reasons why they have so much of an interest in Afghanistan. So if the Pakistanis destabilize Afghanistan, this is not going to happen, right? And so that's another thing that could happen. And what else could happen? One more thing could happen. The China-Pakistan economic corridor could fall into US hands. The US could take control of the CPEC, the China-Pakistan economic corridor, right? So China is in a big conundrum. Pakistan is now very much 100% a US vassal state. The Chinese have no more influence in Pakistan. Take it from me. You may see certain pronouncements and certain statements. And if you are one of those people who places a lot of emphasis on words and not actions, then you will get swayed by that. But it's not happening. The Chinese have lost all control of Pakistan. So the Chinese are between a rock and a hard place. They are in the horns of a dilemma. They are in this deep conundrum. The Chinese have always seen, not always, but the Chinese have always seen Pakistan as a very useful nation, even when it was a US vassal state in the past, during the Cold War, during the first Cold War, the 20th century Cold War. China has seen Pakistan traditionally as its ally. And in the last 10 years, the Chinese started seeing Pakistan as a very strong and vital strategic asset of theirs. So China has always seen Pakistan as an ally and an asset, and the Chinese have always seen India as its sole major Asian obstacle towards China becoming a superpower. And now, Pakistan is in the enemy camp from the Chinese perspective. And India seems to be not in the enemy camp. So that is the great Chinese conundrum. That's what China is facing. So expect things to get better between India and China. Can India trust China? Absolutely not. The Chinese can never be trusted. But you can expect things to get better in a variety of ways between India and China. The Chinese are in a very tough position now. They are not going to be a superpower anytime soon. Their economy is crawling. Their population is aging. They are being encircled. Their semiconductor industry is dead. They are being encircled by the Americans. They have not succeeded in making Russia a vassal state. India made sure this doesn't happen. So now the Chinese are running out of ideas. Their Belt and Road their Belt and Road Initiative is dead. The Maritime Silk Route is not happening. Nobody likes China anymore because of all their actions. And the Chinese, for rightly or wrongly, are being seen as the perpetrators of the Wuhan crisis, of the great coronavirus pandemic. You see, that's what's happened. There is no goodwill towards China from any part of the world. the Chinese are in a very tough position. They have always antagonized India. They've always used Pakistan as their strategic asset to bleed India with or to counterbalance India. That is gone. Now they are in a position to come crawling to India and try to make friends. India can never trust China, but India can use China if there are opportunities for that, right? So that's where we are today. That is the strange situation we find ourselves in. India is not a U.S. vassal state. India is not an enemy of the U.S. either. India is pursuing an independent foreign policy. India is cooperating with the U.S. In a variety of ways, issue-based cooperation. India still would like to have the U.S. on its side. It's the Americans that are seeing India as an adversary. It's the Americans that are running a hybrid campaign against India, using social media, using the media, you know, having thousands of anti-India articles being published. They are arming Pakistan against India, and they are doing all kinds of things of this kind, right? The U.S. wants India to become a complete vassal state, which is not happening. India has emerged as one of the two great powers, one of the three great powers, apart from the great superpower, which is the U.S. The three great powers are India, China, and Russia. So we are living through interesting times. What the future holds for us, we don't know. But we can expect the Chinese to play mischief and to be troublemakers. We can expect the Pakistanis to play mischief and be troublemakers in the region, in Asia. They could very much destabilize Afghanistan, right? They could possibly, depending on what their masters order them to do, they could possibly, I don't know, try something against India like they used to do in the past. And they could even act as a conduit for various terrorist activities against China in the Xinjiang region. All these possibilities are very much open. The Americans could very much take over the China-Pakistan economic corridor. And all these options are on the table right now. So that is about Pakistan. Very interesting times we're living in. China, Pakistan has made a complete flip-flop. It has gone into the U.S. camp. Now what should we talk about? Let's take one more topic. Let's talk about Azerbaijan. Let's talk about Armenia. Let's talk about Turkey, Israel. So I have spoken about this in the past. Let's revisit this from the heartland theory perspective. Right. So as we know, it's recently been announced that India is going to supply Armenia with a variety of weapons, nearly $500 million worth. The Americans are giving Pakistan a $500 million upgrade package for their military. India is upgrading the Armenian military with a $500 million package. Kind of tit for tat. So what's happening here, right? Let's once again look at the geography, because that's how you understand geopolitics. So, like I said, there is this heartland thesis, Mackinder's heartland thesis. And the heartland thesis is that whoever controls the heartland, the pivot area, which is Russia, northern Eurasia, whoever controls that will control the world. So the Americans in the long run would like to take over Russia. You know, that's what's happening. And that's what the Ukraine conflict is all about. But there are other conflicts in the world. One of these conflicts is in the Caucasus region. The Caucasus region is over here between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. That region is the Caucasus region. You know where India is. Go west of India, you have a temporary nation. Then you have Iran. And west of Iran, you have Turkey and Iraq. And northwest of Iran, you have Armenia and Azerbaijan. So that is where the conflict is raging. And essentially what's happening, see, let's understand. Some people say that I am wrong and Armenia are the bad guys. So let's understand what the history is like. I'll not go too deep into history, but understand that Armenia has been around for almost 3,000 years. Armenia has had a distinctive independent culture of its own, an independent history of its own that goes back at least 2,500 years, right? There was no Azerbaijan 2,500 years ago. There was no Turkey 2,500 years ago. Azerbaijan is a Turkic nation. Turkey is a Turkic nation. These regions were conquered by the Turks, the Central Asian nomadic Turks, less than 1,000 years ago. So what is today Azerbaijan has historically been Armenian territory. If you go back 2,500 years or 2,000 years or 1,500 years or 1,000 years or even 500 years, these are territories that have been forcibly captured by the Turkic peoples, and they have settled down over there, and they have done all kinds of atrocities. We obviously know about the Armenian genocide, which the Turks did starting from the late 19th century. There were at least three waves of genocide of the Armenians. The last one was in the early 1900s, the first quarter of the 19th century, done primarily by the Young Turks, Talat, Anwar and Jamal, right? And all that, right? So, and the Turks don't want the world to recognize the fact that there was an Armenian genocide, but they don't miss any opportunity to remind the Armenians of what they did to them, to their ancestors. So that's the thing, right? Now, so this conflict is about, what is the conflict about? The conflict is about dismembering Armenia. It is between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is a Turkish proxy. Azerbaijan is a Turkic nation. They speak the Azeri language, which is a Turkic language. East of the Caspian Sea, you have Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and all these nations, which are Turkic nations. They also speak Turkic languages, and their culture is primarily Turkic. So is Kazakhstan. So Armenia is kind of isolated over here. It is a non-Turkic nation. It's a very ancient nation. So is Georgia. Georgia and Russia have had their conflicts. So Georgia is very much in the NATO camp. Turkey is in the NATO camp. Azerbaijan is in the NATO camp. Armenia is kind of isolated here. So if you look here at the map, there is this small part of Armenia. If you click here, it says Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijanis took over this territory. If you click here, over here, it says Asia. It doesn't say Armenia or Azerbaijan. So what the objective is very clear. The Turks would like to create a pan-Turan corridor through the territory of Armenia, which connects Turkey to Azerbaijan, and then hopefully to further eastern Turkic nations. To do that, they have to dismember Armenia. Right? Turkey is a NATO ally. Turkey is a member of NATO. Azerbaijan is very much pro-NATO, and so on. So this is all being done with the tacit, complicit approval of NATO, which means the United States. There's also the Israeli angle. The Israelis have been supporting Azerbaijan. They have been providing Azerbaijan with various weapons during their conflict, during the Artsakh conflict. Drones, loitering munitions, various other things. So Israel has supported Azerbaijan. Israel is very much a pro-NATO country, right? Israel, essentially, you could say, has a very strongly pro-US foreign policy. I will, out of respect to our Israeli friends, not use the V word, but yeah, that's where it is. Israel also has another agenda, which is Iran. Iran is a sworn enemy of Israel. Iran is a sworn enemy of the US. Iran has made no secret of its desire to destroy Israel and erase Israel from the map of the world. Now, let's take a look at the provinces of Iran. Let's see, what are the provinces like? So here is one of the big things that most people are not aware of. If you look at the provinces of Iran, there is Ardabil, there is East Azerbaijan, there is West Azerbaijan, and so on. So there are two Iranian provinces named Azerbaijan, right? Why is it so? It is so because I think approximately at least a quarter of the population of Iran is ethnic Azerbaijanis, ethnic Azeris. Iran is not entirely in what the Iranians consider themselves to be Aryan, right? Aryan peoples. There are two Aryan nations truly in the world, India and Iran. And the Iranians consider themselves to be Aryans. Well, the Azeris are a Turkic people. They are not Indo-Iranian. They speak a Turkic language. So if you look at the ethnic makeup of Iran, there is a significant Turkic or Azerbaijani or Azeri population in the northwest of Iran that is very close to Tehran. So one of the ways of infiltrating Iran and controlling Iran is via its Azeri or Azerbaijani population. Some people will say Azerbaijan was always a part of Iran. You know, historically, there are all kinds of things that have happened. The map of the world keeps on changing. But this is where we are right now. The Azeri people are not Indo-Iranian. They are not Iranian speaking. Ethnically, they are Turkic and they speak a Turkic language. And Israel would like to, you know, infiltrate Iran. We know Israel has always been a master at the espionage game, the spying game. We know all about Mossad and how they're able to infiltrate any nation from the top to the bottom of the world's hierarchy, yeah, and figure out all the secrets and do their covert operations. They are famous for that. So one of the ways to do that is by using Azerbaijan against Iran in playing on the Iranian Azeri people's loyalties. So that is another reason why Israel has been supporting Azerbaijan. But overall, you can understand the game from the perspective of the map, from the perspective of geography. Turkey would like to create a corridor to the Caspian Sea via the Armenian territory. They would ideally, I mean, if you speak to them in private, the Turkish leaders, they would like to erase Armenia from the map of the world. They don't care. And obviously, Russia will be supporting Armenia. And now that the Americans are supporting Pakistan against India, India has decided to support Armenia. Now, so that's what's happening. It doesn't mean that India and Israel are on opposite sides now. This is a whole different matter. India and Israel have a great deal in common. They have a great amount of strategic convergence. Their interests, India and Israel, the interests converge to a great extent. India and Israel have a great amount of warmth towards each other. There is a great amount of people-to-people warmth as well. So I am not adopting an anti-Israel approach by any means whatsoever. I am just telling you the logic of strategy and the logic of the map, right? So that is what's happening. And that is how, in what way India is involved in the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict. India and Armenia have had very old relations, right? In this region, in the Armenia-Azerbaijan region, there used to be many Hindu temples like 2000 years ago. Those were destroyed and replaced by religious monuments of various other religions. I think you can guess what those religions are. And yet India and Armenia have very old ties, cultural ties, ethnic ties, you know, and all that. So it makes sense for India to support Armenia from that perspective, but it also makes much more sense for India to support Armenia from a geostrategic perspective, right? So that is where we are, and that is the reason why India is supporting Armenia and Israel is supporting Azerbaijan. So I was talking about the Mackinder heartland thing, right? The heartland theory. So one of the ways for the US to make inroads into the heartland area, which is the Russian area, is via the Caucasus. If they can take over parts of Armenia and create a pan-Turan corridor all the way to the Caspian Sea, and then if they can get Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, etc. to come on their side, then that gives them an opening from the south into the heartland, into the pivot area. They're already making a play from Ukraine, because whoever controls Eastern Europe and Ukraine will command the heartland. So the Americans are making two big plays. One is via Ukraine and one is via the Caucasus region, right? So that is the geopolitical, geostrategic game that we are witnessing, and which is something we can understand very well, which we can understand better if we look at the map. So that's about India and Israel and Armenia and Azerbaijan and Turkey and the great new game that is being played in this region. Let's talk about one more thing. Let's talk about Twitter. So Elon Musk has finally taken over Twitter. Let's see. I mean, he has been tweeting about this. Let's take a look at Elon Musk's Twitter account, shall we? He obviously is a very humorous person. He's like a big kid. That's something I have in common with him. So what did he say? Here's what he said yesterday. Yesterday, was it? Yes. He said, the bird is freed. And he also put this video of him. All right. So it's now nagging me to open an account here. Not here. Thank you. And now it will load. So he said that the bird is freed. He took over, he has now officially taken over Twitter. He said that comedy is now legal on Twitter. He also posted a video of him entering the Twitter headquarters with a big kitchen sink, which was a humorous attempt to say that he's going to throw the whole kitchen sink at them. And as soon as he took over Twitter officially, he fired some key people. He fired the great CEO of Twitter, Mr. Parag Agarwal. He also fired the Twitter legal head, Vijaya Gadde. Right, he fired them immediately. He also fired some 2-3 other people, very important, high-ranking people. And then there was this very funny thing which happened, in which two fake employees of Twitter posed outside the Twitter headquarters with these cardboard boxes, and they claimed that they'd been laid off. One of them said his name was Rahul Ligma, and one said his name was David Johnson. And I think it looks like the media took it seriously. So yeah, Elon Musk has not wasted the opportunity to make fun of that as well. So that's what's happening. And he says that now comedy is now legal. And now people are testing the limits of what they can do on Twitter. They are now tweeting things that otherwise they would not have been able to tweet in the past. They would have been banned for that. And yeah. So Musk also said that Twitter will be forming a new content moderation council with widely diverse viewpoints. No major content decisions or account reinstatements will happen before that council convenes. And to be super clear, we have not yet made any changes to Twitter's content moderation policies, which means that the content moderation policies, the oppressive, draconian content moderation policies still continue as of today, as of right now. And no major reinstatements of accounts will be done before this new council convenes. So if you are waiting for Donald Trump to come back, it will still take some time. If you're looking at various Indian accounts that have been banned by Twitter, you know, for whatever reason, you will have to wait for some time. That's what it is. But it's very clear that we are going to see some major changes on Twitter. Maybe Twitter will become more equal. It will stop playing sides. Of course, Twitter is a very major geopolitical tool when it comes to the United States. They can intervene in various countries and play with people's perceptions and ideas and moods and political leanings and beliefs through Twitter to a large extent by you know, trending certain hashtags and blocking certain accounts from saying certain things and only allowing a certain perspective to become mainstreamed. All that is something the US government has used Twitter for. So I'm not sure how that will proceed in the long term if Elon Musk does not allow the US government to do that. That could be interesting to see what the Americans do about that, the US government does about that. There is clearly some kind of friction already between the US government, especially the Democratic Party, and Elon Musk, because he is not a out and out leftist. He is more of a balanced person and so on. So yeah, you could see some interesting things happening on Twitter, right? Elon Musk obviously needs to be careful because he may be the richest man in the world, but he is not by no means the most powerful person, even in his own nation, right? So yeah, that's what it is. Twitter, as we know, has been extremely harsh in the past. They have banned lots of Indian accounts for expressing their views, which goes against every principle and tenet of free speech. In the case of my account, I have had an account on Twitter since 2010. I started tweeting regularly only after 2016 or so. And I myself have been hit by Twitter a couple of times. On one occasion, I woke up in the morning to see that Twitter had deleted exactly 30,000 subscribers from my account. In one single day, exactly 30,000 subscribers gone. Then a few months later, exactly 7,000 subscribers gone. And for like 3-4 years, my following was stuck at, I don't know, 60,000, 61,000. For 3 years, it did not change from there. And then once this news came out that Elon Musk had acquired Twitter, then very rapidly in a few months, my Twitter account subscriber count went from 61 or whatever to where it is today. Today it's around 120,000. Almost doubled in just a few months. So it's clearly that they were restricting my account in some ways. And lots of Indians, you know, lots of people from India have also stated this, that Twitter has been shadow banning their account or preventing their account from gaining more followers. If people follow, then some other people are removed and so on and so forth. So these games they have been playing in India for a very long time, and not just in India, but all across the world. They even banned their own sitting president, Donald Trump, which tells you that there is something in the US that is way more powerful than the US president, you know, and so on. So we hope that Twitter will become a more egalitarian place, a more balanced place. People will be able to exercise their freedom of speech, in genuine freedom of speech, right? And so on. So let's see how it goes. I'm not sure Elon Musk will be able to do everything he wants on Twitter. There will be some pressure from the US government. The US government is currently controlled by the Democratic Party. So it's going to be interesting times on Twitter, but I'm sure that things will improve to a certain extent as well. You may even see old deleted accounts or banned blocked accounts being reinstated. That would be fun to watch. Yeah. So it's fun times on Twitter right now. So I think these are the things that I wanted to speak about. So that's it for today, for today's episode of the Indian Interest. And we will keep on analyzing these matters and matters of interest from the Indian perspective. And tomorrow I will take questions from you in the next episode of Ask Abhijit. So until then, take care. Thank you very much for watching. And I will see you very soon. Thank you. Take care. Good night. Good day.